This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This episode, I'll be talking to musician Fisky about how music provided an outlet and helped him recover in his mental health battles. But before that, this week's Audible recommendation. This recommendation I was reminded of in the interview itself when we very briefly mentioned Trump and I had to shut it down before I went off on a crazy rant. So this is a book by one of my all-time favourite writers, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and it was commissioned by the New York Times. And I'm just going to read a little bit of the description. It probably tells you what it is much better than I could. From one of our greatest writers, a short fictional story about today's befuddling political climate, an imaginary account of a day in the life of Melania Trump, and a fictional glimpse into the lives of the strange family residing in Trump Tower. So it's really worth a listen. It's only short because it was for the New York Times. It's half an hour. But as always, you can get it for free, so it's still good value. Just sign up for a new account with Audible via our link, which is bit.ly/mentalbooks. And the details will also be in the description. So this episode is, as I mentioned before, about music and writing a little bit too, as a positive factor in mental health recovery. However, in the episode, we do cover quite a bit about drugs and Fisky's personal experience there. So I just wanted to add in some stats from mentalhealth.org.uk around drug use in England specifically. So mentalhealth.org.uk found 16.6% of adults in England report drinking to hazardous levels, whilst 1.2% report levels which indicate problematic dependence on alcohol. And then for drugs outside of alcohol, 3.1% of adults in England show signs of drug dependence, and men, 4.3%, are more likely to be dependent on illegal drugs than women, 1.9%. So these are just a few stats, just to reiterate how common problem of drug dependence and addiction can be. Another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit off topic was, now that the podcast is getting into its stride, we're learning more and more from the statistics. One thing that's been particularly interesting is that in the US, our biggest listening base is from Portland, Oregon. I myself don't have any connections or people that I know there, so it may just be a coincidence and there's people out there spreading the word. So of course I want to say thank you for that. And it's also fun because hopefully one day we'll do live recording sessions in the US or some kind of event spanning over the water. And it's really nice to know we have a base, which incredibly, there's a lot more listeners there than many UK cities where we're actually based. So it means if we ever do go to America for anything, Portland, Oregon, that's where we're going. So keep up, I guess, the good work, spreading the word. Drop us a review or a message. We'd love to hear how you guys out there found the podcast and what you think of it, as our biggest international listener base. So 1/4 of our US downloads are currently from Portland, Oregon. There we go. Who knew? And now back to the episode. Here's Fisky. Let's go. And can you just tell us a little bit of where your mental health journey started?
I'd say it started when I was 16, about 21 years ago, with losing my mum to cancer. And then it just sort of, it was quite relentless from then. It was like, then it was my grandmother, who was the only grandparent I ever had, my mum's mum. Then sort of like three friends, all about seven people between the age of 16 and 24. And also my brother when I was a lot younger. So like my earliest memory is seeing my dad crying because my brother had died. So it was all, so that I didn't really know my brother. So it really started with my mum. And then I grew up in a place called Dunstable, just outside Luton. Mm-hmm. And sort of in the 90s, there were no mental health services really. Or if there were, I didn't know where there was, because that was a time before mobile phones and internet a long time ago. So, and I grew up in a culture of let's drink and do as many drugs as we possibly can just because it's Tuesday.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's hard to tell where it became a problem. Sort of after the age of 24, we had a good sort of 7 years when no one died.
Okay.
So I was all going all right. And then when I was about 31, my dad passed away suddenly. And then it just started again. It was like my aunt and uncle, and it was just, oh, God. So I think it was around that time when I started using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate.
Mm-hmm. And you said it started again, so you'd used them previously following the other deaths. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's hard to really tell because I was always drinking and doing drugs, whether someone had died or not. So, but it was really around that time. So I remember when it happened, like all my friends called me because they knew how many people I lost already.
Mm-hmm.
And when my dad passed away, they were like, oh, don't do anything stupid. And I felt like I had to tell them I was all right.
Yeah.
It was,
because you don't want them to worry.
Yeah, it was really difficult because sort of I've always wanted to talk about it since I was 16, but sort of being 16, all my mates didn't know what to say. No one had lost anyone at that age. So it was very isolating. I'm not saying there was no one there for me because there was, but it was the whole being alone, but you're surrounded by people, do you know what I mean? Because no one could relate to what I was going through.
For sure. It can be really isolating. And were there experiences where you tried talking to people about it, or did you just feel there wasn't?
A lot of the people I was talking to were my friends, and it was a lot of drug-fueled, alcohol-fueled. The next morning, it sort of gets forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did try and speak to mental health professionals then, I just felt let down. Like, I walked into a room where I went to my doctor, a family doctor, when I was about 18, and he was like, oh, Paul, I thought I'd see you eventually. Because he knew my mum well and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And knew the family. And he just gave me a phone number. I was like, okay. So I phoned the phone number. Went to this council, and it was just this woman sat in a chair and this other woman with a notepad, and they were like, right, what's wrong?
Wow.
I was like, I don't want this. And I just went and got smashed for the next 20 years, basically, because... And I called rehab a few times, sort of more recently, in my 30s, I think, maybe late 20s. But even then, it was like, okay, so what's the issue? And I was like, well, I've just done 5 grams of coke, 2 bottles of vodka, I'm really unhappy, help. And they were like, oh, yes, you've definitely got an issue, that'd be 4 grand, please. I had 4 grand.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always, for me, it was always like, I couldn't get access and to anything. And I didn't know that you could approach your local authority. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's something we've talked about already numerous times on the podcast is that we're not brought up to know these things. So if you're not brought up in an environment where mental health is openly discussed, and if you're not brought up in an environment where you know what the resources are that are available, then it seems like the obvious and perhaps the only thing you might think to do is just keep it to yourself, is just try and get on with it. It's like that classic British stiff upper lip.
Yeah, it's the whole man up situation as well, isn't it? Because a lot of the times I sort of had to start laughing about things, like, because it just, I think it was 2012, it was just like, it was almost unrealistic how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it started with a breakup, and then she went back to Australia and almost died in a car crash. Then my best mate's mum died, and then the finale was my dad dying. By the end of it, I was just like, you know what? I just started laughing about things and using like dark humour because I'd had nothing else available to me. And I used to work in a big company actually, and that I left in 2016. And there it was like my manager knew there was a lot of drinking. It was media, so there was a lot of drinking and, you know, cocaine's available everywhere. Wherever you go, and my manager noticed something, and he took me aside and he's like, "Are you all right?" I was like, "I'm not really, mate. I don't know how to deal with all these people that are, I haven't dealt with any of them since my mum." And even then, he was like, "Okay," and he put me in touch with the company's counselling team.
Okay, yeah.
So I straight away put me on the phone in an office, and so I speak to them, and I called them, and they were like, "Oh yeah, we can definitely help, but you can't." This was in like February. He was like, "We can help, but you can't join until June." I was like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, because there was some technicality of when you get paid or when you join the company.
Oh really?
So again, I was like, "All right, well, this is like the fourth time, and I keep getting the same stuff. Like, we can help you, but only by these guidelines." So then I was carried on again for like another 5 years, and just, like, just gave up on it. So like, writing for me is the only positive way I've ever had to express myself, whether that was poetry, short stories, hip-hop, anything, like just
That you was had my to only... rely on yourself so much more.
Yeah, because that is a form of counselling for me. Like, if you go to counselling, I went to anger management when I was at uni.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just really angry because I hadn't dealt with anything. And I was getting into fights and arguments. So I went, and by the 10th session, so the first session, I'm sitting there like shaking with anger, and I had a skinhead at the time. I just, mm-hmm. It was kind of my way of just keeping people away from me, I think, so I didn't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And then by the 10th session, she was like, so why are you angry today, Paul? I'm not. I'm bored of my own voice. Mm-hmm. So all it is is talking about it. That's the main thing. All this mental health stuff, well, not all of it, but a lot of it, is just talking about it. And letting, especially men, know that it's all right to talk. Like, nothing's going to happen, do you know what I mean? You're right. You're not going to burst into flames.
Absolutely. And I feel like even within that, you know, we acknowledge, and everyone listening acknowledges, the issues around men in particular, speaking up about mental health. But I think even within that, there's like a sliding scale. Because for me, like, I generally dress a bit more androgynously. I have like dyed hair, I'm skinny. I look to many people more like I'm sort of more in touch with my emotions. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe people that are stereotyped as real man's man, that I'm not, that are far more into the drinking culture, that are maybe into bodybuilding, are into these things we more stereotypically attribute to men. Maybe they have even less support because they're just seen as, oh, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, because you're big, you're fine, yeah.
Yeah, people just can be that simplistic with it.
Yeah, but it's really not the case. I know some people like that and they're fine talking about their mental health. Like, it's really difficult. It depends on the person. I think every person's struggle is different. Every addiction is different.
Yeah, and a lot of it depends, again, on the environment you grow up in. So,
yeah, definitely.
For me, I've, you know, grown up with a really supportive home life. But that being said, I still feel far more comfortable and it feels far more natural for me to talk to friends and even people like you that I've just met about mental health than it can do family.
That's a mad thing, isn't it? It's like talking to someone you don't know can be so much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I run an event called Mind Over Matter where we discuss mental health through spoken word and hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from when I got sober last year. I just woke up on a Monday morning after a 3-day bender on my own. And I was just like, I was unemployed at the time. I was like, what am I doing? And something clicked. I don't know what it was, but I was sitting there. I was like, trying to think, like, what do you care about? And I was trying to get another job in media. I was like, what sort of media do I care about? And I'm actually having a conversation with myself in my room at this point. I was like, no, what do you care about? And all I could think about was mental health, spoken word, and hip hop.
Yeah.
And I was like, what can I do with that? And I put a couple of events on before that went really well. And it's just mad to me that I'm sitting there. I wanted to give people a platform that I never had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mad to me that you, a complete stranger has to put an event on for you to feel comfortable. Like, where is that in your life? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, in any of our lives. That's, to me, was, I don't know, it's just odd.
Well, it's something that, unfortunately, despite all the progress that's been made on talking about mental health and trying to destigmatize it, it still seems to be something that you have to go and get support for.
Yeah.
And it's really disheartening to hear with that experience with your employer, even when they've gone to the trouble to set something up, it's failed you in such a basic way.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, that was my first experience of counseling was through an employer. And they got it set up far faster than the NHS most likely would have. And so for me, that was an ideal way to get going. But no, you're right. It doesn't really make any sense that you have to kind of go outside and find someone you don't know in order to express these things and to feel heard and understood. But I wonder if that's partly stigma and also partly this... how tight-knit families can be, that it can be, for better or for worse, a bit of a pressure cooker, where, like, if I say this, if I say that I'm struggling, how are they going to react to that?
Mm.
And if you're not in an environment where they're talking about it anyway, how do you know that they're going to be okay with it? They may well be. So I definitely, you know, we would actively encourage people here on the podcast to talk to people close to you about issues around mental health, but there's never that guarantee.
Yeah, it's definitely true. But I think it's talking to the right people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though I'm a stranger to a lot of people, they know of me because of the mental health stuff.
Yeah.
And I've made it clear that it's a safe environment and anyone's welcome to express in any way they want.
Yeah. And I think what you're doing in particular is so powerful. I've not seen anything like that that's bringing in spoken word and hip hop exclusively in that environment. They may filter into other talking about mental health environments. But I think that's really powerful because it seems to be, even for someone like me that's so involved in this, more of a surprise when I see a rapper open up about mental health.
You'd be surprised. Like, if you listen to pretty much any rapper, it's all about mental health. All of it. Even if they're just bragging, that's an insecurity. Do you know what I mean? Because I've got to say this, like, I'm so good at rapping, or I'm so good, I've got so many women. Mm-hmm. Why are you saying that? That's mental health. What I've realised from the events is, so some artists, I had an event called Beat Addiction. So I was like addicted to beats and beat addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of them were like, oh, but I don't know anything about addiction or mental health. And I was like, but it's not about that. It's about expressing. Like, we don't have to have like six artists all talking about addiction.
Yeah.
Because I've got 2 albums worth of this stuff, but not everyone has. And I was like, it's not really about that, to be honest. Like, it's also about having a good time and enjoying it. It can't all be about the dark stuff. It's about sort of losing yourself a little bit, do you know what I mean? And just giving you a few hours on a Sunday night where you still have to think about mental health, but you can sort of just enjoy yourself in a safe environment and just, you know.
Yeah, well, that's important, you know, that people can feel they can go and talk about it and equally not go and talk about it. Yeah. Some people just want to listen, and for them, going to an event like yours may be the first step of if they can see people like you, and particularly the younger people that may see artists that are out there and are making it happen as role models, and they can see, oh, you feel comfortable talking about it. I think there's such power to that.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's important for the younger generation, because I said earlier about it can be a surprise to me seeing hip-hop artists opening up about mental health. It shouldn't be. I completely agree with you on how much it's covered in the music. And, you know, specifically, like you say, with drug addiction, that's very much there as well, I think. So it shouldn't surprise me, but it does. And maybe that's my background and the way I've been brought up.
Yeah, possibly. But I think, like, even like to the level of Eminem, like, his music is, mental health is all over his music.
Yeah.
It's just that I've sort of, my event is spoken word, and if you go to a spoken word event, are there any in Birmingham? Do you have them up there?
We do, not so couple, much for mental health, yeah.
But if you go to any of those, it's the same thing. I've just said it's specifically we're talking about mental health. Mm-hmm. But if you go to an event, it's pretty much the same as mine. There's everyone up there expressing in a safe environment. I've just sort of incorporated the mental health thing. So it's not that much different to a normal spoken word event, except it incorporates hip-hop. And we always bring in like a charity or a mental health service to give them a platform, raise the money for them, and get them to talk about what they do. Because I'm not a psychologist. I'm just a bloke that's lived for 20 years in chaos, basically, and then came out of it. So I'm still learning myself about a lot of, and outside of depression and addiction, I don't really talk about much because I'm still learning about it.
Yes.
I always think it's better to bring someone in that works in that environment or lives with a condition if people are happy talking about that. And there are quite a few people that have done it already. And that really helps to dismantle stigma, sort of normalise the conversation. Because if you can understand where someone's coming from, what someone's living with, I think that helps with the whole stigma situation.
For sure. And I think, you know, this episode is about music in particular as a factor in recovery. And I think it's so powerful because it can take it one step further. Not only you would relate to something that someone's put into spoken word or music, you'd also be able to enjoy that experience. So you're connecting with it on more than just a here's a shit thing that's happening for that person, and go further to this is really powerful. I can really relate to this.
Yeah, definitely.
And so could you talk to us a little bit about where music first came into your life and how that started to influence mental health?
My dad was a, a musical producer. So I used to work in a high school or upper school in Harrow and Regis, just outside Luton, where we sort of grew up. And there would always be music around the house. Like, he was very into musicals and like Frank Sinatra and really weird artists I'd never heard of. So he used to have a big jukebox. It was just always there. My mum was very into like country music, like Dolly Parton. But if you listen to my album, it's a hip hop album, but there's a Bette Midler sample on it.
Yeah.
Because From a Distance was one of my dad's favourite songs. So I wrote a song for him about my mum and my brother that's on the album. And then there's all like Oliver Twist samples and all sorts. That's where it came from. It was just always there. And writing was the only thing I was ever good at. Like, if you look at my GCSE grades, it's like FFFFFBBB, like for English. That was like the only thing. I just always enjoyed it. I think I had a poem published when I was 12, but then didn't really do anything until I was sort of in uni, or just coming out of uni, when I was about 27. I went to uni late because I was being a scumbag for like 8 years after my mum. Yeah, but it was really after uni when I moved in with a friend in London, and he was a singer, he still is a singer, and we started like messing around with Cubase, and my first rap song was just literally 4 bars of me just talking. There was no flow or rhythm or anything. But that's where it really started. And then I started getting quite good at it, and people started liking it. So when I released my album, a lot of people would say to me, oh, it's so depressing, it's so deep. But then I was like, what I didn't know was there was the only thing that was making me want to stay alive. Yeah. Like, the only thing. Like, because nothing else really mattered.
That's a reflection of your reality. You know, you could have written about sunshine, but it wouldn't be you. It wouldn't, I don't think, come across as authentic. Yeah, I don't think they would have connected at all.
I don't think at the time many people did. Like, my first album is starting to come, sort of make a resurface now, because now I know people in the scene in London. At the time, I didn't know anyone. I just recorded it in my room. But I think now people are listening to it and thinking, oh yeah, it's not a bad album, if I do say so myself. But it was just so honest, and it was my only way of dealing with things. It's literally like counselling.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
And to come back to, you mentioned of counselling before and how that experience is, you know, ultimately talking. Do you feel like with this it's been equivalent for you, or do you think that there's a lot of issues that you still haven't dealt with?
I think my issue now, because when I got sober about 4 months into it, I started getting those feelings again. It was like, whiskey, remember everyone that's dead? Have some beer. I'll do some cocaine. I was like, no, not again. So I was just like, I called a counsellor again. I was like, this hasn't gone too well in the past. So I Googled like my postcode and a grief counsellor, expecting nothing. So the first one emailed her, I was like, nothing's going to happen. I'll just probably start drinking that again. And then she got back to me, and she was like, call me on this number. So I called her, and she's like, what's the problem? Again, like, so many conversations I've had. Yeah. So I was like, right, this many people have died, it's been going on this long, this is how I've been dealing with it. And she was like, Jesus Christ, you've been through a lot. You can have 4 sessions free. And I think that's all I needed to hear, was someone to recognise what I was going through. Because a lot of my mates, and it's not their fault at all, but a lot of my friends, we'd make a joke out of it, or we just drink and do drugs.
Yeah.
Well, you should be used to it by now, would you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, right, but you're talking about my dead family. And that's something I always struggled with. So I think, like, when she said that, something changed inside me. Because it was just like, someone's finally recognised and said to me, yeah, it must have been hard.
Yeah. It's that validation that it's, despite everything that went on with the drug taking, the situation itself isn't about you fucking up. It's about you struggling to deal with something. And it sounds like she was the first actual medical professional that had given you that validation.
Yeah, I never even met her. It was on the phone. I had 4 sessions. And a technique that they use quite a lot in addiction clinics is writing a letter for me, it was like, I wrote a letter to my mum and to my dad. And she said that, and I was like, procrastinated for about a week and didn't do it.
Yeah.
But then when I eventually did it, the letter to my mum was like 6 A4 pages. It just fell out of me. And I've talked about it in my music and my poetry, like my mum, my dad, like my brother, everything. But you can only get so much into a 3-4 minute song.
Yeah.
And he has to rhyme, and you know. But these two letters, like, because I've been carrying around for 20 years things that I didn't say to my mum that I had the chance to, but because I didn't want to, when you see your mum dying of cancer and there's nothing you can do, and there's nothing your dad can do, there's nothing the doctors can do, that gives you a sense of hopelessness. It's the most important person in my life, and it's like, I can't help her. So I was in denial for a long time that it was going to happen. When it finally did happen, there was stuff that I hadn't said to her. And the same with my dad. I was supposed to see him on the Sunday, and we was at a premiere on a Saturday. I came out of the premiere of a film that me and my friend were in. Came out of the premiere and got the phone call, your dad's dead. I was like, what? And it was like a sudden heart attack. So again, that brought back all that. I was like, oh God, it's both my parents. I didn't say what I wanted to. So I think now that I've written those letters and actually said the things I've had on my mind, because I didn't say them to anyone. It's really weird. It's really therapeutic to end writing in any form. And I think I've dealt with those issues now. But now it's sort of opened up this whole, now I've got rid of the depression and the addiction. It's opened up this whole new thing in my mind, like, what's wrong with the world? Like, why is Donald Trump in power? Do you know what I mean? It's just like, you look at the world and I'm sort of like, I think the best way to change it is to change your world and how you see the world. And then a part of the world does change.
Yeah, be the change.
But yeah, I think I'm always going to struggle with, I miss drinking and doing drugs because I did it because I liked it. I didn't do it for 20 years, so I didn't like it. But it was when it started becoming an issue that I've realised I didn't even like drinking. I only did that so I could do coke. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think it was a free beer rule. You can have 3 beers and then you can, because your thinking changes and it doesn't matter. So, but I've realised I don't really miss drinking, but I do miss doing cocaine, which is, I think that'll always be there. And with the depression thing, another thing the counsellor said was, I don't think you're depressed anymore. I think she called it the depression's healthy partner, which is sadness. And she said, I can hear a sadness in your voice. And I think that'll always be there, because I still do get sad when I think about it and when I talk about it.
Yeah, well, as you've said, there's nothing that anyone can say, there's nothing that can be done that will change that loss and that grief. And that's why I think when it comes to grief, it unfortunately is so much on you, because you're the person that's left behind. You're the only one that can talk about it now. That person's never going to talk back.
It's complicated stuff, grief. It really is. But I think, you know, as time goes on, it gets easier. I don't know if it's easier. Yeah, it probably is easier. It's just time's a healer, isn't it? The old cliche, but it's true.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
But it's interesting what you said about that counselling session, and it sounds great, that experience, that in a way, not only have you got closure on, to some extent, writing those letters, but also you've sort of got a bit of closure on your mental health journey as well, that you've finally had that good experience with a professional. Because my understanding as an outsider to drugs is that they're so often used as a band-aid. Yeah. And so actually, as much fun as you could be having at the time, they're putting all of the bad stuff on pause. It's not going anywhere. Mm. And like you said, you were carrying it for 20 years then.
Yeah, well, what you do with when you're drinking and doing drugs, you're trying to fix an internal problem with an external entity, which is ridiculous when you think about it, because it's not going to happen. I think you had one of my friends on there, Charles Edison,
yes,
a while back. He's actually helped me a lot, because he went to rehab. I think he talked about it on here, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
And he was the one, he mentioned to me about the letters as well. And he's, because I still haven't been to rehab or had like more than 4 counselling sessions, I've sort of had to Google stuff. And I speak to Charles about stuff, and he's sort of giving me tips of what he learned in rehab. But yeah, it works. And like, he's been really helpful, actually. And he's a really good rapper as well. Check him out, Charles Edison.
No, definitely. We're quite keen to have him on again, because he's just so insightful.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes from him speaking out, not only because he's performed at one of your events.
Two
of your events. So I already, before you reached out to us, knew a bit about what you do. But, you know, he does that, and then he does talks in his workplace and various other situations. And I think you can tell that in the way he comes across,
yeah.
is that he's had the time to fully form a lot more of his ideas. So I think he was an ideal first guest on addiction,
yeah,
because he was so quotable. There yeah. were so many things where he just had it spot on.
Yeah, I mean, I've known him for a long time. We used to work together in media,
mm-hmm.
and we've done music together and stuff, and we used to drink and do drugs together. And but he, I've seen a change in him where he knows. I'm like, you know something that I don't, don't you? And he's been helping me with it, but I never had that opportunity to go away somewhere. So like the event, yeah. the event that I run really has become my rehab. It gives me. So it started in August last year, and it was just going to be a one-off event, just for charity for Mind. But then even in the run-up to it, people are, oh, this is a really good idea.
Yeah.
And then the first event I sold out. Pretty much all of them have been around 100 people. And it just kept growing and growing. Like by the second event, we had a stage at a festival.
Wow.
In Northampton called The Grey Dog. That's all focused on young people's mental health. So they, I think it was during, actually, literally in the second event, I got an email from the guy and spoke to him. Now we've got a stage there. We're just trying to raise the money for the stage and sort of help them raise the money for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all about young people's mental health and having it centre stage. And I've got loads of artists, all that are going to talk about their mental health. So that'll be awesome. That's in August. Yeah, and it just sort of radio shows, getting in touch, TV interview. And it just went really well. And it's as long as I keep putting things like that in front of me, as long as I keep doing events, I can't drink or do drugs, even if I want to.
Yeah.
Because I know... And then I can't get on stage and be like, addiction, this, because I've, you know what I mean?
You're I'll setting be drinking that, and doing drugs. That responsibility.
And they'll be able to tell as well. Like, especially people that know me.
Yes.
Or knew what I was like back in, like, last year or the year before. So, like, I had to find a way of keeping myself sober.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, I built a company now on addiction and mental health, so which is a bit annoying sometimes because I can't have a drink. But, yeah, I think it's for the best, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's really brilliant work. And so, at this point, are you just going to keep doing more events? What's your kind of plans for the future?
So I'm actually quite excited. I've been having meetings with like different funding organisations. Excuse me, because I'll be funding it all myself. I started it on benefits when I was unemployed. So I almost got evicted twice because I was paying artists and venues, and I was like 100 quid short for rent. Luckily, my landlord's quite understanding. But my vision for it, for Mind Over Matter, is to have, like... So we have the events, but connected to the events, there'll be services. So one side will be, like, holistic services, like Reiki, yoga, poetry workshops. The other side will be sort of more psychological help, like trauma, addiction, depression, you know, all the other stuff. And I've got people on board already. I've got two psychologists and poetry workshops. I know everyone in the poetry scene, so I've got people that just said, yeah, I'll do that. And my idea is to have a pot of money. And now whether that gets funded by funding or if I fund it myself, it's going to happen either way. So then the people providing the services get paid, which they should do.
Mm-hmm.
But then the people using the services don't have to pay for it. Because one of my main issues was access, like I said earlier. I don't know where to go.
Yes.
And the bigger Mind Over Matter gets, the bigger the word gets, and people know where to go. I mean, it will be limited at the moment because it's quite small, but we'll promote it at the events, and there'll be services on offer for... Like, because people have come to the event, and we've had someone at the last event message me and was like, I was really about to go on a very dark path, and I came to your event, and it stopped me from doing that. We've had people talk to me about addiction and how they've now stopped drinking and doing drugs because of the event. We've had it open up conversations with family members, for audience members that they didn't know how to start before. And I was thinking about this and I was like, okay, that's amazing and like more than I could have ever asked for. But what happens after that? So that's why I want to do it as well, because then if that does happen, then I can say, well, we can offer you this for free. Because like I said, I called rehab so many times and I was like, $4,000. No, I don't have that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm going to send like half of London to rehab because that would be very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am saying is that there will be services on offer. Right, and I can't do the whole of London. I'm just one person.
Yeah, and you're limited as well in what you can offer. There's only so much you can be knowledgeable on. There's only so many services you can signpost. So even if it's just having someone, you know, speak in an event or be there to answer questions for where people can go next, it's just taking that next step. But it doesn't mean that people have to be reliant on your service forever.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that I knew very early on going into podcast, we'd have that social responsibility. It wouldn't be enough to just do this. We also have things like our resources page on the website so that people can take it further. If something comes up for them that they relate to in an episode, they immediately have places they can go and look at.
It's just knowing where to look. That's really all it is, I think. Yeah.
But I think there's such power in that, that you've just seen that gap and you're creating the thing that you never had growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it all just happened. Like, when I left, I was at this company for like 10 years and got promoted once. The first 4 years I did all right. Mm-hmm. After that, I just didn't care. And I kept trying to get promoted, but I couldn't. So eventually I just left because they moved offices and they offered us money. So about 100 people left. And then I was trying to, like I said earlier, I was trying to get a job back in media, doing the same thing. And I had 20 interviews and I couldn't get a job. And then I realised, I just had to stop and think and realise, like, in the interview, the last question they'd always ask was, so, Paul, why do you want this job? And in the back of my head, I was like, don't. I can't think of anything worse than working it. And by the 20th, I'm a bit slow, by the 20th time, I was like, what am I doing? And then a lot of my friends at the time were like, no, no, keep going, you'll get one, you'll get one. I said, yeah, you don't understand, I don't want one. I don't want to work in that environment anymore. So that's when the drug taking and drinking got really bad. Like, I mean, it's always been really bad, but then it was sort of went to another level. I didn't know what I was going to do. And this has just grown so naturally. It's like the universe just went, yes, this is the path, now go. And think people are like are coming to me for things that I've got going on in my head that I'm thinking about. Like the next week, someone will contact me and with that idea and stuff like that. And it's just...
Yeah, it sounds like you're exactly where...
Yeah, I feel like for the first time in my entire life, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm not making any money out of it. I've lost thousands of pounds, but people are like, oh, but you're losing money. And I'm like, it's not losing money. It's an investment.
Yeah.
And if I help one person per event, that's money well spent to me.
And you could put anything down to losing money. You know, someone could equally turn around to me because I have private counselling and saying, oh, you're throwing money away. But it's what it means to that person.
Exactly.
This has clearly been so therapeutic for you.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. It's, you know, it's the same with me doing the podcast. It's crazy the power and healing that I find just listening to other people's stories.
Mm.
There's so much to be said for that in just normalizing it. Even with someone like me, where I didn't really think I had internalized stigma. Maybe I'm finding out now that I do. There's still some more work to go. I wanted to bring in a stat as well here, in terms of the work you do and how important it is. So this is from, let me just double check my source. So this source is from the NHS, and they found in 2006, there were 2,593 registered deaths in England and Wales related to drug misuse. So that's bad enough in and of itself, but one of the reasons I'm so glad with what you're doing is out there is how much that's risen. So this was an increase of 5% compared to the previous year, 2015. But if you take it back 10 years, it's a 58% increase compared to 2006. I have all these stats and sometimes I have to double check them because they almost don't seem real. And that's something we've talked about on the episode I recorded just before this one, is that there's so much need there. And that's in a way a little bit the downside of... trying to encourage conversation about mental health, because it doesn't actually increase the demand realistically. We're not converting people to being mentally ill. We're just allowing people to realize that and talk about it and seek help, hopefully.
That's the thing, it's really hard. Like I said, I was doing it for 20 years and people said to me all through those 20 years, you're drinking and doing drugs too much.
Yeah.
But I didn't care because at the time, it was medicating me to an extent. And then the whole thing is with addiction is no one can change it but you. Like,
change for me happened instantly, literally a split second. But it took me 20 years to get to that point where I wanted to change. So along with, like, my two main focuses with Mind Over Matter is, like I said, access and also prevention, working with young people. Yeah. Because if that counsellor hadn't just said, all right, what's wrong, and acted like she cared, it might have been different. I don't know. It might not have been. But it would have been nice to have that option sort of back in that day. So prevention and access for me at the moment are two things I want to work on. I want to get young people involved with the events, maybe even arrange an event, sort of they choose the artists who they want to see. I mean, not like Stormzy or someone like that. Like, let's keep it in budget. But and there's a whole in London, there's this massive knife crime epidemic at the moment.
Yes.
So I just like try and keep kids off the street and just stuff like that, really.
And that's again why it's so important to get in there young, because we see these statistics, whether it's knife crime or whether it's mental health statistics, most of them are rising year on year. And so there's only so far you can go tackling the people that are already dealing with these issues. You actually need to go into the root and try and prevent it in the first place. It's
really difficult, though. Really difficult, isn't it? Because I remember when I was a kid, like, I didn't want to listen. That's one of the issues, because when you're 16, 15, 16, you don't know who you are yet. You're still finding out who you are.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's hard. I mean, like I said, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't really talk much about this sort of stuff, but yeah, we definitely need to do something with the youth.
Yeah, but that's why I think even just getting the conversations more mainstream is a start, because then they'll be hearing these things, whether it's through music, whether it's through podcasts, whatever, they'll be getting access to this information and hopefully just enjoying that experience anyway, and maybe not even realising how informed they're becoming.
Sort of subconsciously, like the rubbish you get on the radio nowadays. What's that bloke's name? 6ix9ine or something. Have you heard about him? Don't even look him up. I can't even be saying his name on a podcast or radio. But like that whole negative thing of, like, you know, what kids listen to nowadays, and it's there so much that it has to have influenced the whole knife crime thing and or the whole, you know, the violence thing, because it's constantly there. Do you know what I mean? So if we could change that and make it a little bit more positive, then maybe subconsciously they'll be nice to each other. Do you know what I mean?
And it's easy for a successful artist to talk about carrying a weapon when they have bodyguards around them.
Yeah.
And when actually, I very much doubt that's true anyway.
No, none of them do. Like, if you're a famous rapper, you're not shooting anyone.
No.
I don't care who you are. Like, it's not happening. You're not going to, because they're going to know who you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it does happen. Like, probably more in America. I think it does happen here as well. I don't know. It's that whole narrative that needs to change, but you can't stop. It's, again, it's a form of expression, and they're free to express that. You can't really argue with that. Do you know what I mean? That's the issue with freedom of speech as well, which is a great thing. But people are free to express whatever they want, so they're not really doing anything wrong, probably in their eyes, the artists.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but I think there's always a social responsibility.
It's whether they choose to take that on, isn't it? That's the issue.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that often it takes something extreme. It takes someone being inspired to violence off something someone said.
Yeah.
Or it takes someone dying from bullying for people to realise the extent of it. So I think it would be very hard for any artist to become, to reach a certain level of success and not have experiences where people have gone to very dark places off the back of them not being socially conscious.
Yeah.
So if they're being ignorant to that, I don't have sympathy for them. I don't know how you could, on one moment, say how much you love your fans and how much you appreciate the support, and then not also think about what they're getting from you.
That's the thing. I don't know, but that level of fame, and there's just so many issues within there. Like, fame's not real. This is my thing with it. Like, I don't want anything to do with that sort of thing. Like, I want Mind Over Matter to get out there, but I don't want anything to do with that sort of life, because it's just not. If you speak to anyone that's famous, like really famous, if you watch an interview with Madonna or something, like, I'm sure David Bowie or someone, they will in those interviews, they will say that fame isn't going to cure anything.
Yeah.
It's not going to make you happy going on Big Brother or whatever you're doing. Like, people just want to be famous for the sake of being famous, like just so everyone knows who you are. But what do? What message are you putting out there?
And I think that's a great advantage in what you do, because obviously, you know, I hope that you will reach that level, that you'll get so much success off what you do and putting that out there. But the benefit is that you're coming into with Mind Over Matter, you're coming into hopefully the public consciousness with a good message in the first place. So by all means, you know, take over the world with it, because you know, because it's working for good, and it's coming from a very true place of you're taking it from yourself, you're taking it from your negative experiences, what you've had to overcome, and applying that to others. And I think it'd be difficult to go far wrong if that's how you're acting.
I hope so. That's sort of the plan. I might have to pay someone to be the face of it though when it gets too big. I don't want that hassle in my life.
So we're coming near the end of our time. So I just want to finish up with maybe two things. First of all, I'd be interested to know, having gone through everything you've gone through now, and you've got sober and you've had some professional help, is there anything you would want to say to the younger version of yourself?
God,
I know it's a bit of a stereotypical question, but well, I feel
like,
it's relevant.
I quite like the question. Part of me thinks that the younger me wouldn't listen. Well, I know that he wouldn't listen, because I didn't listen to anyone. I'd probably just say, eventually it'll be all right. Mm-hmm. Probably stay away from the drugs and the alcohol. But then, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's it's a weird thing, because I'm not that person anymore. Do you know what I mean? And for that person, if I change that person, then I'm not going to be the person I am now. Do you know what I mean? I don't think I change anything about what's happened. That's not true. I'd like my family to still be here. Do you know what I mean? If
I know what you mean, that ultimately, for better or for worse, that shapes who you are now.
Yeah.
And you may not be running something like Mind Over Matter without it.
And if my family were still here, well, I still have like sisters. I've got a sister in America and some in Kent, but I only really see them when someone dies. But I think, like, if I still had everyone still here, I'd probably be in like a corporate job. And God, thank you, I did that for 10 years. But yeah,
ultimately you are who you are. There's only so far you stray from that. So maybe it would have taken longer for you to get a wake-up call and realise that you need to be doing something for yourself.
Mm.
Maybe have your own project like Mind Over Matter. And that may well have just come round through working in a corporation, like you said with the interviews, and just realising it's not where you meant to be.
Definitely.
And then one more thing.
Okay.
In terms of where you are now, is there, what do you see as your personal journey outside of Mind Over Matter? Is there any more support you feel you need? And is there anything that really helps you personally that others may find useful?
Like I said, personally, writing really does help me. That's the only thing that's ever helped me, really. What was the other question?
Do you think that there's any more support potentially from the medical profession that you'd want at this point?
At the moment, probably not. I probably will try counselling again, because it was just sort of on the phone. What I'd say to people is, if you do write, or if you're creative in any way, that is a massive help, but it's not a cure. So get out what you've got to get out on the page. But also, if you need it, seek professional help. Like, look for it. Approach your local authority, or get in touch with me and I'll put you in touch with someone.
Yeah, well, there's not really any situations I know of where people have had too much support.
Yeah.
So why limit yourself, you know?
Exactly.
Access everything you can.
So
final thing then. Do you want to tell us a little bit about where we can find you online? Do you have any upcoming events?
Yes, we've got... we've actually got one in Birmingham.
Oh, awesome.
On 25th of May. It's at City University.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's open to the public, like it's for the students there. I don't even know. When's this? This isn't live, is it?
It's not live.
I'm just ruining the surprise.
Let's see when we're
No, I think people know about it. But yeah, that'll be at City University on the 25th, I think, for the students. They're doing a mental health day.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady that works there that also knows one of the rappers in London that I know got in touch and said, would you bring it up here? And we're like, yeah, of course. But our next main event in London is Chester P, who's like he's a pioneer of UK hip hop, really. I don't know how he feels about that, but that label. I actually met him briefly on yesterday. I was at a Park Jam in London, like a free event, and he was performing there, and I sort of went up and said, like, oh, because we've been talking obviously about the event, so I just met him briefly, but he was just, people just like descended on him, so I didn't get a chance to talk to him properly. But he's someone I used to listen to a lot when I was going through that stuff with my mum, because his words, he literally said things that I was thinking, and I was like, oh my god, there are other people that are lost, like. So he's bringing back an event he used to do called the 5-word freestyle trial. Okay. Which is where we've got 6 MCs who we're going to be announcing tonight. You can follow us at Mind Matter LDN, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And the 6 MCs and the crowd shout out 5 words, and then they have to come up for freestyle. And we've got a beatboxer instead of a DJ. So.
And can you do that? Because as an outsider, that baffles me.
I can't freestyle, no. I have trouble remembering the stuff I've written, to be honest. But no, it's an art. It's a lost art. Because there's a whole thing nowadays about people put stuff online and it's like, this is a freestyle, but it's not freestyle because you've written it and you've recorded it. That's not freestyle. But there's a debate about that, whether that is a freestyle or not, because there's 2 meanings for it now, apparently. Which, one thing about hip-hop is you're never short of debates.
Well, that's one thing the internet loves to do, is just think up new meanings for words.
I don't know, I think there is something to it. I'm not really sure, but I know that, you know, I've seen people do it, I saw people do it yesterday, and it baffles me as well how they come up with it and stay on beat as well. There's a lot of a cappella freestyle stuff, but I think this one's going to be on beat, and there might be a cappella stuff. But yeah, the more I'm doing it, I'm just meeting artists that I used to listen to. And we've got a few more events that I can't even believe that I'm talking
it's
to these people.
It's incredible though, isn't it, the way that if you're in the right place in your life, these things just seem to come to you.
Yeah, it's insane.
Round. Okay, that's our time, unfortunately, but thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
And for just doing what you do, really.
Thank you. Keep doing what you're doing as well.
And now, an account for a healthier online world. So this episode, of course, we'll be recommending Mind Over Matter on Twitter and Instagram. You've heard in the episode all about the incredible events they run. Hopefully with a bit of input from us, we can increase the number of them in Birmingham, maybe even do a collaboration event. Keep an eye out. So the best thing to do to keep up with the events they have is take a look at their Instagram and Twitter, which are both Mind Matter LDN. So is in London for short. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.